This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hey, this is Trey. Thank you for joining us for a Tuesday edition of our podcast. Hope you had a wonderful weekend and a great beginning to your week. Spring is definitely here, which is beautiful in most ways and temperamental in some ways. Weather changes pretty quickly. Lots of stuff flying around. My deepest sympathies to those who suffer from allergies. This is a tough time of the year, but I guess it's kind of a metaphor for life. You got beauty and struggles and all of it kind of wrapped up in one. A couple of things on the mind which might be worthy of further reflection. Actually, I think they're definitely worthy of further reflection, even if there's not necessarily a consensus at the end of that reflection. Been thinking, because it's been in the news, questions remain on the origin of life. It's been part of our national dialogue and debate and discussion, sometimes argument, for decades. It's much more than just a political issue. It involves many parts of life that people hold dear and personal, including their faith. On the judicial or political side, conservatives once argued issues of life and autonomy and abortion should be left to the states. Abortion does not appear in the United States Constitution, the word, it is true, but neither does marriage, family, education, Air Force, the explicit right to travel. Some rights are assumed. Some rights have evolved as the world has evolved. Others are left to the people through their elected officials to sort out. The Constitution was never designed to include everything. It was designed for the people to fill in the blanks. And if there is something important enough to be made permanent, such as an amendment to the Constitution, well, there's a way to do that, too. So while many rights we assume exist do not appear in the text of the U.S. Constitution, interestingly enough, the word life does appear twice. In addition, it appears in the Declaration of Independence, as in, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal, endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Among these are life. There is an argument, a constitutional argument, for a national standard on when life begins and all the other issues surrounding this debate that has kind of captured our country for half a century. So I suppose we fundamentally must ask ourselves if the 50 different laboratories, which are the states, were really set up to have 50 different opinions on when life begins and how and when it should be protected or balanced against other interests. You know, with COVID, many of us marveled, and I don't mean marveled in a good way. I mean, we marveled at how a virus could shut down the world in some states and yet leave other states to operate pretty much in the status quo. And yet we're told to rely on science, which meant science either had multiple personalities, or the science was clear, but people were free to ignore it, or the science was evolving, or the science was politicized. I mean, the reality is science does evolve. You know, today, I think, I haven't checked the newspaper, but I think today eggs are okay. Yesterday, not so much. Coffee. Some articles I read says, yeah, have all you want. Some, not so much. Salt. Wine. Different studies bring different results. But with life, is that really subject to the vagaries of which state you happen to be in? So there are the constitutional implications. I mean, what about the political ones? And I don't mean politics in a derisive way. I mean politics as in the people decide. If the election were today, the border and the economy would definitely, I think, be the leading issues, but not the only issues. Republicans underperformed in 2022, in part because Democrats cobbled together a constellation of less dominant issues, which in the aggregate proved powerful. Among those issues was abortion. You know, Dobbs sent the issue back to the states, but Republicans consistently lost on state initiatives. And in the process, some were seen as being out of touch with many voters, especially female voters. You know, such is politics. You make the national news in an awful way when you take extreme positions, such as arguing for murder charges or maybe even capital murder charges for women or for doctors. Politicians who argue for that are few and far between. I know that. But we also know fame and numbers don't correlate. In fact, there's a built-in incentive to be in the minority these days because there's less competition for attention. So the fact that there are only a few people out there arguing for such extreme positions, we should be wise enough to know the media is not going to ignore the smallness of the number. In fact, they're going to accentuate that. I mean, some lawmakers advocate for putting women and doctors in prison. Some advocate for forcing rape and incest victims to go through with birth. Likewise, some on the other side think pregnancies only end at the very end of the birth canal. One academic even argued for post-birth ending of life. I recall the fervor with which some of my former colleagues used to argue for being more humane with those who were about to be put to death. Now, keep in mind, they were about to be put to death for committing some of the most horrific crimes, unspeakably horrific crimes. But my former colleagues on the other side of the aisle were arguing that the death penalty was cruel and mean and painful, and we should find a way to either eliminate the death penalty altogether, or if you're going to have the death penalty, be very mindful of the pain that could be caused in the last few moments of life. In fact, some death penalties were put on hold because anti-death penalty advocates did just that. They advocated that there was pain associated. So let that sink in for a second. Some of the worst crimes that have been committed against other people that terrorized these people and filled them with pain in the last seconds of their life were just unspeakably awful. And yet there were my colleagues arguing for a more humane way of putting these awful people to death. What about a humane way of ending life as nascent as it may be for the unborn? Is that too much to ask? Anesthesia, some pain relief for the most innocent among us. So when does life begin? And who decides? And can it be ended? And by whom? And in what way? And in terms of the origin of life, just in the last month, we've heard conception, 6 weeks, 12 weeks, 15 weeks, when a heartbeat is detected, when pain can be felt, viability, and birth. There's little consensus on the GOP side, and that doesn't even address the issue of exceptions for rape or incest or the life or health of the mother. And when, as I do, ask Democrats when life begins, because that's a pretty fundamental question, you also don't get an answer, because the focus often is not on the life of the unborn. I mean, for a party that spends so much time talking about the marginalized and the weak and the powerless and the voiceless and the weakest among us, they just don't seem to get much advocacy. In truth, most Americans seem to have settled on something of a consensus. Grudgingly, after decades of decisions and divisions and debate, it seems voters are following the line of that former president that abortion should be safe, legal, and rare. But even that leaves the question of why something should be rare unless there remains some moral uncertainty about it in the first place. And so we enter the second half of a century debating still a fundamental issue of life. We'll be right back with more of the Trey Gowdy Podcast.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Janice Dean, Fox News senior meteorologist. Be sure to subscribe to the Janice Dean Podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to spread the sunshine.
here we are headed into the next 50 years. Really no closer to an answer. But people are using technology to do what we have always done, which is resolve questions like this in a light most favorable to life. The argument against the death penalty was always that, what if you're wrong? There's no appeal. You can't remedy it. And the same is true here. What if you're wrong? What if the beginning of life really is life? What if it is the moment that it initiates? What if life is the forming of a heart, the delivery of a soul, the ability to feel pain? If you're going to err, if at all, why not err on the side of life at the earliest, given how fundamental the right is and how forever the consequences of being wrong? And so at the core of that is whether issues of life and when it begins and who decides and how to balance against other interests, is that a constitutional issue, a religious belief, a moral issue, a medical issue, a scientific issue, or is it all of the above? Yeah, I prosecuted a rape case where a woman did, in fact, become pregnant as a result of an unspeakably violent rape. Staggeringly awful facts. And every one of those cases dents your soul just a little bit, because it dents the soul of the victim for the rest of her life. It's a life sentence for the woman assaulted, period. And most men cannot grasp, no matter how hard we may try. And I did try. I tried to grasp it so I could be the best advocate I could be in court. But there is no way I will ever know what they experienced or continue to experience. This particular sexual assault victim decided to keep the product of that violent rape, and she put her child up for adoption. Prosecutors do not discuss these issues with rape victims. But I remember being left in awe of her courage and her willingness to testify and her strength before trial. And I left knowing that while I might have an opinion, it was her that was left with the consequences of whatever she decided. And today there is life because she chose life. And why she did it, I don't know. I just know this, it's the most fundamental gift and the most fundamental right of all, and she chose it. Something else that dominated the news, back to the House of Representatives, where they fought over FISA this week. I would encourage you to get the facts on FISA. I'm not going to try to persuade you. I have my opinion on it. What I really, really lament is the misinformation as it relates to FISA on both sides, quite frankly. So get the facts on what FISA does and what it does not do, and how it's used and how it's not used and how it's been abused in the past, particularly whether too many FBI agents have the authority to access and use information. That's what I argued a long time ago, back when I was part of these debates. We needed to narrow the number of people who had the power to do it, because the more people have the power, the more potential there is for abuse. You know, sometimes the policy is bad. Sometimes the policy is good, but the people administering the policy are bad. So how do we know when to change the policy versus change the people? That's the challenge. I mean, we have warrantless searches and arrests all day, every day in this country. I mean, you should always get a warrant when you can, and most do. FISA information is collected initially pursuant to a court order. What happens with the collateral information is what's at issue here. And it is true, the FBI brought much of this on itself. But there's still misinformation about what the program does and who does it and why. So get the facts. And I also couldn't help but notice that there was an amendment offered by Congressman Andy Biggs, former Freedom Caucus chair, and Pramila Jayapal, who might possibly be the most liberal member of the House. They joined forces together. Ordinarily, the media would like it when the hard right and the hard left come together. My initial reaction when the hard right and the hard left comes together is to look harder. Surely we must be missing something. If you disagree with Pramila Jayapal on 99% of life, what makes you think that this is that broken clock that happens to be right twice a day by accident? And then after the amendment, and the amendment was a warrant requirement amendment, after the amendment failed, Matt Gaetz did what he always does, which is somehow try to make it about himself. He said he would go campaign against people who did not vote the way he wanted them to vote. So let me see if I got this right. You're going to actively work against Republican members because they did not vote for an amendment put forth by Congresswoman Jayapal, who, by the way, objected to Trump's election on the House floor in 2016, skipped Trump's inauguration, never had a decent thing to say about Israel. In fact, said Israel was a racist state and never had a harsh word to say about Hamas. In other words, if you're progressive, she's a hero for you. If you're not a progressive, she should scare the daylights out of you. But if you didn't vote for the amendment she co-sponsored, then Congressman Matt Gaetz said he's going to be coming to your district and going to work against you, which I find, well, I better not say what I find that. Let's just go with interesting, because Speaker Mike Johnson voted against that amendment. In fact, you could argue he was the deciding vote. So the irony of life, the guy that Gaetz helped put in the speaker's chair because of his personal hatred for Kevin McCarthy, wound up casting the deciding vote on an issue Gaetz says is so important he will show up and campaign against whoever voted against it. You know, some parties just aren't built for the majority. They're just, some members aren't built for Congress. They're built for reality TV shows. Lastly, and most practically for most of us, more research is out this week about young people and the epidemic of unhappiness in which they are seemingly mired. It applies to all of us, the search for happiness. Does money make you happy? In the short term, maybe. And in the long term, we do need enough to not worry about it all the time. Beyond that, it's what you do with it. If you spend the money to help other people or create memories with people that you love, then yeah, it can bring you happiness. Does fame make you happy? It appeals to that part of our brains that covets being noticed. But the newness wears off fast, and you will one day, I promise you, I assure you, you will covet your anonymity once again. What really makes us happy, and this is what the science tells us, is leading a significant life, helping others, especially spending time with people that we care about. That's the secret. And we only get one shot at this thing called life. Happiness is a state of mind. It's not a feeling, but we can nurture it and we can pursue it and feed it the right things. Yes, we need a basic amount of money. Yes, we like it when people know who we are. Yes, we like compliments and don't like insults. But most of all, I think we covet meaning and purpose and significance. And that is most often found doing things for other people. The happiest people I know spend the least amount of time thinking about themselves and the most amount of time trying to make life better for others. So in closing, thank you, Arthur Brooks, for the research and the expertise, and thank you to each one of you, especially my wife, who proved that Arthur Brooks is right. Happiness is doing important things as often as you can for other people. Have a good week. I'll see you next week. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts. And Amazon Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.